and welcome to Comic Talk Today for Monday, September 3rd, 2018. And yes, it is Labor Day in the U.S. But you know what? I'm still recording because holidays mean nothing to me. I'm a party pooper and hate days off. This episode is the episode of the week in which I talk about some of my favorite reads from this past week, which means this is the top of the pile. And this week I've got quite a few books I want to talk about, and I'm gonna give you a warning ahead of time. I think all of the books that I'll be talking about on this episode are horror comics. You may disagree with some of my choices, we'll get to that when we get there, but there's some really good books out this week. On the list I have one Aftershock, two DC, one Jinx World, which I guess is kind of DC, two Marvel, one IDW, and one Boom. And first up on the list is The Beyonders, number one from Aftershock Comics. This is written by Paul Jenkins with art by Wesley St. Clair, letters by Marshall Dillon, and boy, was this comic good. I talked about it quite a bit with Travis on the Aftershock Central podcast, so I'm going to do a brief overview on it. If you want my full thoughts, go check out that episode. It's the latest episode, I think it came out Friday or Saturday, so you can check out my thoughts. But this was really, really interesting. This book is being billed as kind of a YA book, which I found interesting because I understand why. But, I find oftentimes that the YA thing, the young adult thing, can be a bit of a misnomer. Because I think there's ways to do books that can have a wide appeal. And I think sometimes making a book a YA book, billing it as a YA book, marketing it as a YA book, is a little unfair to that book. But this is really interesting. It's about a boy named Jake who lives in Alaska with his aunt and uncle. And, he's kind of got nowhere to go, you know? He lives in a small town. There's really nothing to do except work in a fishing boat. And, he kind of spends his days going over conspiracy theories because that's what he really loves to do. And, you know, he's in high school. He's a senior in high school. So he's trying to get into college. Nobody's accepting him. And his guidance counsel is like, look, you're not really going to do anything with your life. Why don't you just work on the fishing boat? I've got you an internship, at this place. I think it'll be good for you. And he's like, no, he's like, I'm too smart for this. I don't need to do it. So he's going through his conspiracy theories, which I find the most interesting part of this book. There's a few things that are really great about this book. Number one, well, first of all, let me just get the art out of the way. Wes St. Clair, this is freaking fantastic. I love the art style. It's a lot tighter than the last book he did for Aftershock, which was Fujitsu, but it's beautiful to look at. The story is really interesting too. So Jake is obsessed with conspiracy theories. He is constantly looking for the connection between all kinds of historical events, and the book pretty much opens with that. There's a set of like 8 to 10 different conspiracy theories that are run through in this particular book, and Jake tries to find connections between each and every one of them. And the connections make total sense, so I really dug that. I love the fact that we're diving into this world where we're getting something a little bit different, right? There's not many comics, I think, that actually deal in conspiracy theories. At least not very often anyway. So I really like that because I love conspiracy theories, not because I believe any of them, but because I think they're really fun and interesting and say a lot about the way that people think, right? Like we're so creative in the way that we try to explain things sometimes. And I think conspiracy theories are among the most creative stories that we come up with. And it's really cool because there's connections about some Chinese and Turkish cartographers who supposedly discovered America before Christopher Columbus, like 100 plus years before Christopher Columbus. That ties into a murder that happened in the late 90s in Missouri, which ties into the Antikythera device that was found on a Greek ship that nobody knows what it is, but they assume like a not prehistoric, but an ancient computer. And I thought that was really interesting as well, about like Chinese settlements in California. There's stuff about mind control with the CIA in the, I guess, 60s, 70s. I don't know if they gave a timeline for that, but that really fascinating stuff. I really enjoyed how much effort was put into making this story really something unique. And I think because of that, you really should be checking out Beyonders. I thought it was absolutely fabulous. It's a very fast read, and there's some crazy stuff that happens in here. Because after we find out that Jake really has no future aside from working in a fishing boat, weird stuff kind of starts happening. There's a massive thunderstorm. He loses power a couple times. And then during one of these power surges, his aunt and uncle are watching TV. And all of a sudden, they go in a loop. And you see that they're actually robots. So there may be a little more to Jake than just an average kind of guy. And he might not be aware of any of this stuff. And it doesn't seem like he is aware because he's very surprised to learn that his aunt's face has exploded. Really cool way that it was done, though. I thoroughly enjoyed it. During one of these thunderstorms, he's doing like chat roulette and meeting up with different girls and talking to them online. And he meets up with this one girl who ends up being one of the eponymous Beyonders. And she's like, come with me if you want to live. And I love that because there's so many like sci-fi tropes that are thrown into this book. But they make sense. They don't feel tropey. And I loved it because it's so fun to read. I really enjoy this. It's very different than really anything I think Paul Jenkins has done before. And I think this is one that you should definitely be picking up again. There's a ton of things to like. If you like sci-fi, pick this up. If you're a conspiracy guy, pick this up. If you just want a really fun, great comic that's innovative and creative and does something different, then Beyonders is a book for you. I'm going to score this one a 4 out of 5. Over on the DC front, I'm going to talk about Daffy Duck versus the Joker. This is one of the Hanna-Barbera crossovers, and there's two, and I'll be talking about both of them on this episode. This is written by Scott Lobdell with art by Brett Booth, inks by Norm Rapmond, colors by Andrew Dalhouse, and letters by Wes Abbott. And I really enjoy these Hanna-Barbera crossovers with DC characters. This one was, I think, one of the most straightforward ones that we've had out of the whole batch. You know, they did quite a few titles last year. They're doing them again this year. I think they just announced a new batch coming out next month. So I'm really excited to read these. I always pick them up because they are fantastic. I kind of wish that they collected these in a trade. And maybe they have for the ones that came out last year. I don't know. I should check. But if you know that they collected these, let me know on Twitter at GeekVine. Because I wouldn't mind picking these up in trade as well, even though I own all the single issues. Because, yes, I'm a double dipper. All right, let's get back to the book. I found... All right, so the writing choice for this made perfect sense to me. Scott Lobdell is... He can write some pretty funny stuff. And so I figured he would do well with this title. The surprise for me here was choosing Brett Booth as the artist. And what I find fascinating about all these Hanna-Barbera books is oftentimes it seems to be the case that the artist that should be on this book doesn't quite match what I have in my head should be that artist. And it works so well. I mean, Brett Booth has been in the industry for decades, right? He kind of became a big name, I would say, in the early to mid-90s. He did a bunch of stuff for Wildstorm that I really love. Matter of fact, the Backlash series he did was freaking awesome. I loved it. But anyways, back to this book. His style is very different, right? And the thing is, it's a little creepy to see sometimes, to be honest with you. Because when we actually see Daffy Duck, his full body, it's kind of creepy to see, right? Because if you remember the Hanna-Barbera cartoons with Daffy Duck, the Looney Tunes stuff, he was a duck. It was a cartoon duck, right? And he looked like a cartoon duck. In this comic, he's still a cartoon duck, but he's very much more anthropomorphic than I remember seeing him. I mean, let me tell you, birds have some crazy looking legs. This Daffy Duck has some jacked up, calves. And I don't mean that in a bad way. Like, he's been working out. So, anyways, it was a little creepy to see, but I enjoyed it. So basically what's going on is you've got the Joker plotting these criminal activities in Gotham. Meanwhile, you have Daffy Duck somewhere far away. It doesn't really say. Really, actually, it was kind of funny because the way they describe it is Gotham is like the city of crime, and then Daffy Duck, like, not where the crime is. So I thought that was pretty cool. But he's waiting on an order from Acme Corporation. Of course, Acme is huge in the Hanna-Barbera stuff, right? So he's waiting for this thing, and he hasn't received it, so he calls the tech support line, and he's trying to talk to somebody, and a computer picks up. And God, let me tell you, I hate when that happens. I do a lot of customer service stuff. And, you know, whenever I need support for something and I call a place, the one thing that I hate is always having to talk to a computer before I can get to an actual person. And that's not always the case, actually. But for the most part, it is. In fact, my phone company is brilliant. Like, you get 3 rings and you're with a person. There's not even a computer. I'm not going to say who it is because it doesn't really matter. But they're brilliant. You know what? I will say it's Ting. If you don't know about Ting, I'll tell you about it later. Find me on Twitter. I'll tell you about it. So he can't get a person on the phone. He's like, you know what? Screw this. I'm going to go to Acme headquarters and see where the hell my package is. And he goes, and Acme's been shut down, which is probably why he hasn't received this package. Although the timing seems a little weird, right? Like, why is he trying to get this thing if the company's been shut down? But as it turns out, Joker is using the abandoned Acme headquarters as his own headquarters. And Deffy goes in there, tries to find out where the hell his stuff is, and Joker's henchmen find him, they grab him, Joker's ready to kill him, and he's like, no, don't kill me, I'll be really useful to you. He's like, the company sent me, the Acme company sent me, I'm your new henchman. And he's like, oh, brilliant. He's like, you are exactly what I need. You're the new lead henchman. So it's pretty funny, actually, because he gets a lead henchman t-shirt that he wears around, and you don't see a whole lot of it, but if you pay attention, you catch it. And so Deffy kind of becomes the guy that plots all of Joker's crimes in Gotham City. And Joker's got this idea of spreading the Joker venom in an amusement park. And Daffy's like, this guy's freaking crazy. I can't do that. Because, you know, Daffy is one of those guys that he's kind of a trickster, right? But at the same time, he's got a little bit of a moral code. So the juxtaposition is pretty interesting. And he manages to swap out the gas. And it's pretty funny. He's like training all the henchmen to be proper henchmen. They're doing like workouts in the park and whatever. And the gas goes off. And Joker's like, wait, like they're just sneezing. They're not even dying. And Daffy's like, oh, maybe I swapped out the gas by mistake. And this is when Batman shows up and Commissioner Gordon, and they end up grabbing all of Joker's henchmen and the Joker. And Daffy's like, holy crap, I gotta hide so they don't catch me. So he hides in this like pile of stuffed animals. And of course, Gordon and Batman don't know that he's, well, I think they kind of know that he's there, but they don't really say that they know he's there. And so, Batman starts talking about ducks, how ducks are just stupid and they just follow the herd and this and the other. And Daffy gets super mad and comes out and starts yelling at Batman, and, that gets him arrested. So of course, Daffy and the Joker end up going to Arkham Asylum. Really interesting story. Not at all what I expected, but, really quite enjoyable. I was surprised that they made it work as well as they did. And I think it's mostly because of the comedic action. It's very fast paced and it works really well. So I'm going to head and rate this one a 4 out of 5. I really enjoyed it. I don't think there's been a single Hanna-Barbera DC crossover I have not enjoyed in the past year that they've done them. And this is a pretty good one. The one that's even better though is the Lex Luthor Porky Pig crossover. Employee of the Month. This is written by Mark Russell, who of course did Flintstones over at DC. I think when that just ended, right? A couple months ago. And a brilliant book. Art by Brad Walker, who I believe was the artist on the Flintstones as well. And this one is actually really, really interesting and extremely deep. And I was not surprised by that. I expected this kind of story from Mark Russell because this is the kind of stuff that he did with the Flintstones. Oh, I should say, inks by Andrew Hennessy, colors by Andrew Dalhouse, and letters by Troy and Dave. I like that. Whoever Troy and Dave are. So, basically the way the story's set up is Porky Pig is the CEO of this, like, blockchain company, so they've got, like, Porky Coin or whatever it is. I thought that was hilarious. Matter of fact, a lot of this is very much topical to today, in particular if you're aware of anything that's going on in tech. Because it's kind of a riff on the whole cryptocurrency craze, which, full disclosure, I do own some cryptocurrency. It's not worth anything, but whatever. It's based on that. There's a lot of social media stuff in here. So Porky Pig runs this company, and it's like the biggest thing in the world, right? Everybody's buying this Porky coin. They're all trying to get rich off of Porky coin. And of course, Porky becomes extremely wealthy as a result. In fact, they even show, I can't remember the name of the guy, but there's that super weird guy on that finance channel, he's always like really super energetic trying to get people to buy stocks or not buy stocks. And there's like weird antics on there. And, they even play on that on here because the guy's like spanking his butt with a paddle and there's like pigs running around or whatever. I thought that was pretty interesting. And as soon as he's like, yeah, everyone should buy Porky coin, the market for Porky coin crashes, Porky goes broke. And, loses his job. He's got nothing, nowhere to go. All his wealth is gone. Cause of course, it's not actual wealth, right? That's the interesting thing about all these tech companies, is a lot of the times, the wealth that the CEOs have or whatever, it's just based on the value of the company, which really isn't a value at all. It's just kind of intrinsic value. The stock market's so weird. But anyway, we're not going to talk about finance in this episode. So he's broke. He doesn't know what he's going to do. He ends up getting a job at his favorite restaurant. And while he's on his first night as a waiter, Lex Luthor shows up. And he's serving Lex Luthor, and Lex is like, "Oh wait, you're Porky, you're the Porky coin guy." And he's like, "Yeah, that's me." He's like, "Hey, I'm gonna offer you a job." So he brings Porky Pig into Lex Corp to run their new, I think it's called like Lexmark or something like that. I can't remember. The new social media company that Lex Luthor is trying to launch. And so Porky's running the company. He's trying to get new user acquisition. And he's like, "You know, this platform's a little weird." He's like, "Why are these people so weird?" And Lex is like, "Oh yeah, like this thing is just, you know, we're allowing everybody that got kicked off of every other social media platform to join our platform. Like that's how we got this thing rolling." And Porky's like, "That's a little odd, but okay. Like, you know, you seem like a really awesome dude," because he's giving Porky like employee of the month plaques and this, that, and the other. And, you know, telling everybody how great Porky is. And of course, Porky's eating that stuff up because he just had a really bad time with his own company, right? And, but really interesting, right? Because I think about that, like, social media now, especially, golly, this past week, there's been some crazy stuff going on. I talked about it on, whatever the last episode was. I talked about the Marvel and Alterna social media policy stuff. But really interesting. So it plays a lot on that. And, you know, Lex really is just after profits. In fact, at one point, one of his henchmen's like, "Why are you even running a social media company? Like, there's no money in social media." And Lex is like, "You're right." He's like, the reason that I did it is so I can steal everyone's passwords, because everyone knows that once you create a password, you use the same password in every single website that you go to. So now I have everybody's emails and everybody's passwords. And of course, I thought that was hilarious because I'm a huge nerd about security, as some of you that listen maybe be well aware. I choose ridiculous, like, 30-plus character passwords. I don't remember any of them. They're all saved and encrypted. I do, like, two-factor authentication. I do all that stuff because part of the reason is this, right? If my stuff gets out, it just can't be reused somewhere. So I thought it was really interesting that Lex is using that as his business model, because it kind of is the same way in some respects with social media now. In particular, Facebook, when they try to do all these different desperate things that you're like, well, what does that have to do with social media, right? Like the Facebook Watch stuff with the videos, on their Messenger app, you can like send people money, you can order stuff. They're trying to figure out a way to do like, checking account balances and things like that. And that's played upon in this issue as well, right? So Lex is like, "Oh, we're going to do this thing where we can order stuff from our app." So he orders like Viagra kind of, right? Erectile dysfunction medication. He's like, "Great, your pills are on order. Like, they'll be there soon." And as this is happening, of course, all this happens publicly because in social media, everything's public. And the user starts trolling Lex on this app, and Lex gets super upset. And it turns out, actually, funny enough, that it's Daffy Duck. And that whole thing was pretty funny. As things progress, Lex is actually sent up to Congress for a hearing because there's all these rumors about the insecurity of the application. And he's like, "Look, I knew nothing about it." He's like, the app is run by Porky Pig. He's the one you got to ask questions to." And of course that leads to Porky going to jail, and it gets kind of sad. In fact, he gets no visitors in jail because everyone's kind of left him because he's broke again, right? Everyone that knew him was friends with him because he was rich. And, the only person that goes to see him is his literary agent, which also was hilarious because that also happens a lot, right? Somebody commits a heinous crime and, they end up making a ton of money as a result because they write a book about it and everyone wants to read it. So really interesting stuff on here. It's, I would say one of the most serious of the Hanna-Barbera books that I've read, but really enjoyable. If you enjoy that kind of stuff, you might dig this book. I thought it was actually really, really well executed. So I'm going to give this one a 5 out of 5. Let's go over to Jinx World, which is, of course, Brian Michael Bendis' imprint at DC. And it used to be at Marvel, now at DC. And it's a brand new number one with Scarlet number one, written by Brian Michael Bendis, with art by Alex Maleev, letters by Joshua Reed, designed by Curtis King Jr. And this was actually really interesting. I wanted to talk about this. I'm going to get the rating out of the way. This is a 3 out of 5. because I want to use that rating as a lead into the discussion. I thought the book was actually really quite good. It's very interesting because it does play around with the comic format quite a bit. And I'm going to get to that in a second. The art I thought was really well done as well. I saw some people complaining that it just didn't feel quite like Alex Maleev art. It felt a little more dulled down, I guess, in some ways. And I could see that, but I think that fits this book very well. Because in some ways this is kind of post-apocalyptic, but not really. Like, there's no real apocalypse, right? And that leads into my rating for this book. Because while this is a new number one, part of the problem that I had with this issue was that Scarlet was already a series previously. And the events that lead to the creation of the world that we see in Scarlet number one are not really very well described. There's like a two sentence blurb at the beginning of the issue, which explains what happened to Scarlet prior to this. And it's what happened in the 10 issue run that Scarlet had over at Marvel. And I didn't see how those two things connected because I never read Scarlet, the original Scarlet series. So coming in pretty much completely blind as to what the series was about, I kind of wish that it had been a little more new reader friendly, right? Because we really do come in, it almost seems like halfway through the action. So from my understanding and what's mentioned in the little blurb at the beginning of the issue is that there was some kind of thing between Scarlet and her boyfriend. The cops ended up trying to arrest her boyfriend, and they made him the fall guy for something. And as a result, she wanted payback, so she went up against, I think, Seattle PD. And that caused the event of this book to happen, where Scarlet is kind of like the leader of this rebellion, right? So when this issue starts, she's already famous. She's the leader of a rebellion. Everyone sees her as this, like, independent image where people strive to be like her because she's kind of freed them from police corruption is kind of what I got. But we don't really see any of that stuff, right? I would have loved to see some flashbacks as to how all this stuff happened. I think that would have made sense. And it could have been done pretty quickly in, you know, maybe two pages just to kind of bring us back into this world. With that said, though, I thought it was really well executed. And again, the only reason I'm rating this a little bit lower is because I was confused as to how we got to the place where we're at in the story. Because the writing is actually really well done. It's really interesting the way that the word balloons are done. And I didn't catch this until about halfway through the book. So I'm going to explain this as I talk about this book because I think it might help some of you understand the way to read it a little bit better. So normally when we have a comic, if you have dialogue, you're used to seeing the dialogue as a word balloon. It's a round balloon, right? That's what's called a word balloon. And it's got the letters in it. And that's how you know who's talking, right? Because the little circle has a little foot going to the person that's speaking. Whenever you have narration, you don't have word balloons. You have boxes. And those boxes have like inner monologue, or they have descriptions of where you are or when you are or previously in, or, you know, this is happening here, this is happening over there, whatever it might be. This book shies away from that. There is none of that. Every single word balloon is somebody talking. And the difference here is when Scarlet is talking to another person in the action, in the page that you're reading, it's a round word balloon, the typical style. When she is talking to you, the reader, it is a square box. But the difference is you can't really see it because they both have that little foot that usually indicates a person is speaking, not just there's a narration going on. And I thought that was really interesting the way that was done because I've never seen that before. I've never seen that before. And I thought it was fascinating because you don't usually have a lot of characters in comics breaking down the fourth wall and talking to the reader directly. And the few times that you have that, it's kind of comedic, right? Like Deadpool does it a lot, right? Breaking the fourth wall is kind of his thing. But it's still done in a word balloon. Whereas this is different. And I didn't catch it at first because while she's talking, I'm like, well, that's cool. Like they chose square boxes instead of round boxes for the dialogue. And that wasn't the case. And when I realized what exactly the difference was between the two dialogues, then the story kind of started coming together a little bit more. Cause at first I was like, well, that's weird that she would say that to this person, but she wasn't. She was saying it to me. And I really liked that. I really, really enjoyed that. So, Overall, actually, it's quite good. You've got Scarlet. She's leading this rebel force. There's kind of, another group that she meets up with, and, they end up kind of joining her. You have, this guy that drops in from the sky who's, I think, part of a SEAL team, maybe. He's definitely military. And, they're about to shoot him. He's like, wait, don't shoot me. He's like, somebody wants to talk to you. And he hands them a satellite phone, and apparently it's the White House. Because the government has kind of shut down the whole city based on this, rebellion that's going on. So there's no power anywhere. Nobody can use phones. And, the White House wants to see, like, how can they appease Scarlet and make this whole thing stop so things can go back to normal. I thought that was really interesting. Which leads me to believe that come the next issue, this will rate a lot higher for me because we'll actually really get into the action. Or at least I'm hoping so. But the really interesting stuff, I enjoyed Scarlet quite a bit. And like I said, even though I rated it pretty low, it's mostly because of the fact that we're coming halfway into a story than the actual issue itself. Because the issue itself is actually really quite well done. The writing's fantastic. The pacing's very good. In fact, the pacing was a lot quicker than I expected from a Bendis independent comic. So that was a nice surprise. And regardless of what other people say, I thought the art was fantastic. I think it works really well here. So again, 3 out of 5, but this book has a lot of potential and I'm really excited. Bendis has another book coming out, I think in 2 weeks, called Cover, about a comic book artist who's also like an undercover secret agent. I think that should be pretty interesting as well. So we'll see how all that ends up going. Over on the Marvel front, I want to talk about the Web of Venom, number one. Now, I don't know if it's Web of Ven-Am, or if Ven-Am is the title of the issue. It's a one-shot. It's a one-shot issue. It deals with the guy that we met in the Venom ongoing series, the guy who was one of the original symbiote possessors in Vietnam. And we get a lot of backstory on him. So Web of V-E apostrophe N-A-M, written by Donny Cates with art by Juan Ramirez, colors by Felipe Sobrero, and letters by Clayton Cowell. And this is actually really interesting. It takes place in Vietnam. And one thing I wasn't expecting is, number one, Nick Fury, which maybe I should have expected because there's a definite S.H.I.E.L.D. connection in the Venom ongoing. The other one did not expect at all was Wolverine, the original Wolverine. So that was nice to see. And basically we get the origin story of the first team that S.H.I.E.L.D. assembled who had symbiotes attached to them, right? We saw those characters. If you're reading the Venom ongoing, you know what I'm talking about. If you are not reading that, you're going to be confused. However, I think this issue is very well done and a great standalone story, because even though it ties directly into the Venom ongoing, you don't need to read that to really understand what's going on. Everybody's introduced here, so you get the whole story up front. In fact, the majority of this book centers around Nick Fury and Logan, so, you know, there's no need to know about these other characters. You will get additional information if you have been reading the Venom ongoing. But it tells the story of this team, right? They were created by S.H.I.E.L.D., so we learned that S.H.I.E.L.D. Found the symbiotes, and they started experimenting with rats, and it didn't go very well, but they're like, this will be a really good weapon, so supposedly Nick Fury's like, oh, we shouldn't do that, but, you know, he's a government man, so he went ahead and did it. At first you're kind of like, oh, okay, Nick Fury, like, that's cool. And by the way, original Nick Fury, eye patch, old white guy with the gray hair, Nick Fury. And as the issue progresses, we learn that that's necessarily the case, right? And I gotta say, I really like this almost evil Nick Fury. I think it's a much more interesting character than just kind of like the lead of S.H.I.E.L.D., right? Like a, you know, whatever, I'll do whatever my country needs. This is that, but taking up another level. And I enjoy that. I don't think we've seen this Nick Fury in quite a long time. And it worked very well for this issue. So he sends his team out to Vietnam to stop the Viet Cong. And the team ends up being lost. So he enlists Wolverine to go with him to Vietnam and try to find out what happened to the symbiotes. And from then on, it actually reads like one of my favorite movies of all time, Predator. It very much like that. There's not a whole team, right? It's just Nick Fury and Logan. But, you know, they're going through the jungle. They're being kind of hunted by the symbiotes. And it plays out very much like it. In fact, there's a couple of scenes that are very much like from the movie. Matter of fact, one of the guys, he starts like rattling off his machine gun, and it looks like that scene with Jesse Ventura when he's shooting through the jungle trying to get the Predator, and he can't get him, right, because he's invisible. I really enjoy that. We get some more backstory on these guys and, like, you know, where the symbiotes went. Logan and Nick Fury have to fight the symbiotes, and they end up using fire, of course, because symbiotes hate fire. They use fire to kind of ward them off. They end up having, like, a sound gun. That's how they end up defeating them and bringing them back into S.H.I.E.L.D. for further investigation. And that's when they get put into cryo, right? So they're put into cryostasis only to be reawakened in the Venom ongoing, because they can't really be controlled. And the whole thing was really interesting. I like the fact that Wolverine is here because he provides kind of an interesting viewpoint on things. In fact, at one point, he gets possessed by a Venom symbiote and attacks Nick Fury. I thought it was really interesting, actually. And this, of course, all happens before Wolverine joins the X-Men. So there's a little joke in there about how Wolverine wouldn't be a good team player, and I really dug that as well. The art is brilliant, by the way. You know, the art in Venom is fantastic, and Stegman has done, I mean, he's kicked it up several notches in the design, the way that the book is done. Because it's a very dark book, right? It reads very much like a horror story. And this one is a horror book in Vietnam, and I love that. I wish we had more of that stuff, because you can really play around with the horrors of war, real life horrors, by the way, not horror of the genre, but the horrors of war oftentimes lend themselves very well to really interesting, deep psychological horror stories. And, this is not quite that, but it's approaching that. And it works really well. So I hope that if this is successful, Marvel will kind of take a hint and maybe try to do some more of these stories. Because I would love it. I know many listeners to this podcast love war comics. I think you do some really cool, interesting things with war comics. And, you know, this is a good example of it. Good example of it. But yeah, this Juan Ramirez, I'm not sure where he came from, but he does do a pretty good job at imitating Stegman's artwork from the Venom ongoing, with his own touch, of course, and it works very well. So really, really enjoyed this book. A 4 out of 5 for me. I hope that if you picked it up, you let me know what you thought. I think they might be doing like a series of Venom one-shots now. There's an ad at the end of this one for When of Venom Carnage. So I'm looking forward to that. Carnage was one of my favorite characters back in the 90s. And I kind of lost track of him when I quit reading Spider-Man stuff. But I'm looking forward to see how Carnage will change now that we have all this mythology around the symbiotes and the history of the alien race and this god of the symbiote thing that's going on. So should be pretty interesting. But Web of Venom, that's a pretty good one. I really enjoyed it. Real quick, I want to talk about Extermination, number 2 of 5. Of course, another Marvel book. This is the event book in which somebody's hunting down the original X-Men. And, of course, we learned in the last issue, spoiler alert if you haven't read it, that's your spoiler alert, that Cable is the one after the original X-Men. We don't really know exactly why yet. We know that there's some reason why them being in the present is really destroying the timeline. And Cable's trying to dispose of them in order to fix that. And of course we have Ahab in here, which, you know, speaking of terrible 90s characters, I mean, God, Ahab was awful back in the 90s. But he's actually pretty interesting in this book. I'm glad that they chose him. It works pretty well. Scott is, of course, trying to deal with the aftermath of Bloodstorm being killed in the first issue. And I talked a little bit about Bloodstorm last time. I really don't know where the character came from. So if you know a little more backstory on that, let me know on Twitter at Geekvine, because I'm interested to learn a little bit more about the character and why Storm is a vampire. But really interesting story. A lot more straightforward, I think, than the first one. We don't really get any new revelations, right? Except for the fact that now all of the X-Men know that it's Cable that's going after them, and they need to deal with the repercussions of that. And I really enjoyed it. This Pepe Larraz art, I gotta tell you, this guy needs to be on Uncanny X-Men when they relaunch that. I mean, it's just fantastic. You know, we talked about last week about how when you have a tentpole book, you have to have your best artist on it. This guy is a freaking genius. I foresee Pepe Larraz being one of the top Marvel talents for many, many years to come. 4 out of 5 for me on Extermination number 2. On to Boom Studios, we have Bone Parish number 2, written by Cullen Bunn, with art by Jonas Scharf, colors by Alex Gomez, and letters by Ed Dukeshire, with a brilliant cover by Lee Garbett, of course. You know, I was looking at Lee Garbett's Big Cartel page, and he's got no Bone Parish covers on there. I wouldn't mind these Bone Parish covers. Just saying. I'm sure they're not the cheapest thing, but I wouldn't mind the cover. Anyways, of course, Bone Parish is the book set in New Orleans in which this family has created a business selling this drug called ash, and ash is created from dead bodies. And ash gives people hallucinations in which they can relive the memories of the dead people that the drug is made out of. Kind of like iZombie, if you read that comic or watch that TV show. Kind of similar, but of course this is much darker, whereas iZombie is a little, it's got some comedic elements in there. This one does not. It's very dark and very much a crime story, because this family, the father's dead, so the mom is running the criminal empire, and some of the kids are cool with it. Some of the kids are not. In fact, the oldest son feels like he should be in charge of the family and the business now that the father's gone. You know, there's also this whole thing with like the Sicilian mafia who want to buy out the business, and maybe the head guy might be romantically interested in the mom. We'll see how that plays out. I thought that was pretty interesting. And, what changes in this issue is that one of the drug runners for Ash, is actually overdoses on the drug. And so now the police are kind of very much aware of this drug. And, most of the issue centers really around the family dynamics. We learn a lot about the daughter who is the scientist that created the drug. And, she's got a really interesting backstory and very dark. It almost looked, like a little play on 50 Shades of Grey. She dated this guy called Lucien, if I'm not mistaken. And, he's a little creepy. He's a little creepy. They have sex around like dead bodies or like skeletons, maybe some mannequins. I don't know. It's quite odd. They both have a very great fascination with death. And, he seems to be the one that introduced her to how to create this drug, because apparently they had created the drug at some point and they knew it worked, because it seems like they had tried it. But now Lucien wanted to try it with living bodies. And in fact, after they have sex, he takes her into this room where he's got a girl chained up and gagged. And he's like, you know, it worked before. You know, what kind of experience can we get from the living? And, I mean, that just upped the creep factor quite a bit. You know, when you're dealing kind of with the dead bodies, it didn't feel as gruesome and gory and I don't know, visceral, violent. But once you see that this guy is going to experiment with living people, it does make it a little bit creepier. And she's a little freaked out about it, but she doesn't seem like she doesn't want to do it. Although there may be something that happens between the two of them where she does decide that this is not something they should do. Because we do see at one point, she's doing a dissection on a dead body and putting pieces in jars to make this drug. And, one of the jars has Lucien's name on it. So there's definitely something that happened. And, you know, it could be that she kept it because, she wants to relive her relationship with him, just like her mom did with the dead father. But, really, really interesting stuff. This book is, you know, I think it's one of the darker books that Cullen Bunn's done. It's also one of the most different horror stories, I think, as well. And, it works on so many levels. It's very psychological, and I like that, right? Because it makes you think when you're reading comic. And, one of my favorite things to do when I'm reading comic is find all the little pieces in each book and try to gain some deeper meaning into what the writer's trying to do. And this book does just that. So, I mean, Bone Parish is brilliant. I hope if you're listening to this, you are reading it. I talked about the first issue. I'm not talking about the second. And I don't try to repeat a whole lot of books when I do these podcasts. So, pick this one up for sure. Bone Parish number 2 is a 5 out of 5. By the way, that Jonas Scharf art, holy moly. Fantastic. Final book I want to talk about is from IDW, the Black Crown imprint. This is House Amok number 1, written by Chris Sabella with art by Sean McManus. We've got letters by Aditya Bidikar and colors by Lee Laffridge. And this one's actually really interesting. I was a little confused at first, to be honest. I was a little confused, but for some reason, the way that the story was being told was really engrossing to me. In some ways, the family that we meet in this book seems very off the rails, almost a little insane, if you will. The way that they act towards each other doesn't seem very realistic, to be frank, and that's done on purpose. And you can definitely tell it's done on purpose. So it didn't put me off in any way. It's like watching, like, family sitcoms from, like, the 80s, right? Or, like, the 90s, like, the TGIS stuff, where everyone's just, like, so friendly and so lovey towards each other, and they do anything they can to help each other. And, of course, we all have families. We know that that's not really how families work. But it's kind of like that, right? Like, kind of gross in a way. The main characters in this book are twins, twin girls. They're very young. I don't think they explicitly state an age, but they can't be more than 8 or 9, I would say. One of the twins is definitely a little more into this odd family than the other. And that plays a large part of how the issue ends. But, you know, it opens up very strangely. The two girls go into a gas station and, they steal a pair of glasses. Of course, the gas station clerk comes after them. The mom's waiting outside and she's like, I know that they stole the glasses. I told them to steal them. And, she points a shotgun at his face and he's like, whoa, what the hell's happening? Their older brother shows up and he's wearing like a Jason mask right from Halloween and a machete. And, they kind of scare the guy off and they're like, yeah, we needed this guy. We're doing this to save you. And the whole time I'm like, what do you mean they're trying to save him? Well, it seems like the family is on a road trip looking for these vortices that are around the world. And the one that they visit in this issue is in Oregon, the Oregon Vortex. And, they give a little history about the Oregon Vortex and what it is, and this guy that went there and found the vortex, and how he made connections to other vortices around the world, and how they're like ways to get from our world into like a different dimension. And they want to explore this house and see if they can find out the meaning of the vortex. And it seems like they do, because they get to this one house and there's this weird carousel that just, it turns on when they get there. And, there's like little fractures in space where they can see alternate timelines, I would assume. You know, it's like the city that they're in, but in one image, the city's flooded. One, it's like on fire. One, it's being attacked by like a dragon or something. And, they're kind of freaked out. They run away. At the same time, there's these murders that are being investigated in a basement. At the same time, we see these weird creatures, these black creatures with red faces that just show up at random places. And obviously nobody else can see them, but this family can. In fact, in one page, they run over one of these guys as they're driving away. Really interesting stuff. I'm not sure what to think of it. But what I can gather is, because they do mention what these beings are, and it seems like now they're being chased after these beings. And they may be responsible for keeping reality normal in a way. There was a movie that came out, I want to say 97, 98. It was right before, like a year before The Matrix came out. And, if you ever watch it, it watches a lot like The Matrix, but it's much darker, and, really loved it. It's got Kiefer Sutherland and I can't remember who the main guy is, but it's called Dark City. And Dark City, it's set kind of like a crime noir type story, right? It's set almost like in the 40s or 50s, right? Same kind of dress, same like gothic architecture style. And there's a couple different plot lines going on, but ultimately we learn that there's a group of beings that are responsible for keeping reality in check, but they also do things to fix mistakes that people do. So like if you go out and kill somebody, but you weren't supposed to because you'd be elected president, let's say, I'm just making this up, they would go and like replace certain aspects of the city in order to change the reality, right? And they could do like memory wipes or mind wipes. You know, if you went to kill your wife, like, and they didn't want that because that wouldn't be for the best interest of the future, they would like stop you from killing her, and they would, or they could marry you to a new person, right? And you wouldn't know, right? They stop time and they change reality right in front of you. And then you're unaware. And so when they bring everything back to normal running time, then, that thing would actually be something that you knew your entire life, right? Like you would have been married to that person your entire life and not to the person you just killed, because you wouldn't even know you killed somebody. A lot of these things where they change reality in some ways. And we don't see these characters in House of Muck change reality in any way. But we do learn that they are kind of the protectors of reality. And so I'm really curious to see how that plays out and why this family is so fascinated with this, so obsessed with it. Because they're very, very odd group of folks. You know, the kids are homeschooled, which, I mean, that's not weird, but that seems to tie into kind of this weird fascination they have with the Vortex. But I thought it was a really strong first issue. The one issue that I had with it is that there's a lot of narration from the twins, and as a result, it leads to a lot of reading. And I'm okay with books that have a lot of word balloons, a lot of narration. But what I like about those kind of books is when they show me more than they tell me, right? And when you have a lot of words on a page, oftentimes the book seems to fall back to a tell over show. And, you know, as somebody who took many a writing course, the one thing that we're always told is always show the action, right? Don't tell somebody what they're seeing. Show them what you want them to see. And as a result, it seemed to me like there was a little bit more telling than showing. Of course, it's only the first issue, so I do expect some of that in the first issue. And it's not necessarily a problem for me. Because I gotta tell you, I loved this book. I loved it. I thought the art was fantastic. The pacing's really good. The characters are really fascinating. And there's so much different. There's so many different things going on with the story, that this could go into some really interesting places. In some ways, it reminds me of one of my favorite TV shows of all time, Fringe. So, we'll see how it ends up going. There's a little wrench thrown in at the end where one of the twin girls, it kind of seems like she snaps out of this trance that she's in. And she's like, yeah, I kind of snapped out of it and I realized my family's insane, but do I leave or do I stay? And that's kind of how the book ends. So I'm really curious to see where the series will go. But I thought for a first issue, it was absolutely fantastic. One of my favorite reads of the week. So it's going to be a 5 out of 5. Now it's time to talk about some of the books coming out this week that I'm excited to read. And there's quite a few. There's always a few books that I want to talk about. Pestilence, A Story of Satan #4 from Aftershock Comics with Frank Thierry, Oleg Okunev. This has been a really fun book, second volume again. And I hope that if you listen to this podcast, you read this because I've talked about it a few times. I really enjoy it. It's a fresh take on the Black Plague of medieval history. And it's what if the Black Plague was zombies? And with this second volume, we learned that these zombies came about because Satan brought them to Earth. And the last issue was extremely gory and violent and changed the story quite a bit. So I look forward to this one. Relay #3 after from Aftershock. It's Zach Thompson, Andy Clark, Dan Brown. And this is actually a really interesting story. Very, very Philip K. Dick. Of course, Zach loves Philip K. Dick. So it's to be expected. I'm really enjoying this book. So looking forward to issue 3. Also from Zach and his writing partner. And art by Peter Kowalski is Coming to Me from Black Mass Comics. And I'm glad this is coming back. There was kind of some kind of snafu with the scheduling on this third issue. So it's been like 2 or 3 months, I think, since #2 came out. I'm really excited to dive back into this book. I might have to go back and read issues 1 and 2 once again. Batman 54. I mean, do I have to tell you to read Batman? Yeah, I do, because I hated it for so long. This seems to be a Nightwing-centric story. And apparently this is going to be huge. So I'm putting this on the list not just because it's Batman, but because it seems like there's going to be a lot of changes going on with Dick Grayson, starting with this story arc beginning with issue 54 of Batman and then moving into his own ongoing Nightwing title. It should be pretty interesting. There's going to be something that happens where Dick kind of has to change the way he fights crime. So looking forward to seeing how this story will impact the future of Dick Grayson. Predators Hunters 2 #2, Chris Wagner, which I love, and I love the Predator franchise, so I'm loving this. It's set in Afghanistan and follows a reconnaissance mission of a group of army guys looking for the Predators. First issue was really interesting, so I'm looking forward to this one. Border Town #1 from DC Comics. This is part of the new imprint, and this is Eric Esquivel with art by Ramon Villalobos, and this is really interesting. I'll read the synopsis. When a crack in the border between worlds releases an army of monsters from Mexican folklore, residents of Devil's Fork, Arizona blame the ensuing weirdness, the shared nightmares, the otherworldly radio transmissions, the mysterious goat mutilations on god dang illegals. I got to read the first issue already and it's really good. Really good. It is a little political, but, it's very well veiled in the story. I think you'll enjoy it quite a bit. Of course, I talked about cover number one already. This is Brian Michael Bendis. I believe it is David Mack on art. And again, it's the comic book artist who's like a secret agent at night. Should be pretty interesting. I'm really enjoying these Jinx World books. The Dreaming number one from DC Comics, of course. The Dreaming from the Sandman side of the universe. Simon Spurrier, Bilquis Evely, and Jay Lee covers. Man, those Jay Lee covers. Oh my God, I want them all. This should be pretty interesting. The Dreaming was one of my favorite stories in the Sandman universe one shot. I talked about that, I guess, 2-3 weeks ago now. So this one should prove pretty interesting as well. Also from Brian Michael Bendis with art by Michael Avon Aiming is United States versus Murder, Inc., 6-issue miniseries. And, it's kind of an alt history of the United States, and it reads, years ago, five families of organized crime had such a stranglehold over the American public that the U.S. government found itself forced to be give part of the country or lose it. Now the unrest between America and the families has come to a boil. A war is about to come, a war no one is ready for. Should be pretty awesome. I'm looking forward to this one. I'm not a huge fan of Aiming's art, but we'll see. We'll see how it goes. From Cullen Bunn over at Marvel, we've got Asgardians of the Galaxy. And yes, I said Asgardians, not Guardians. This one should prove to be pretty interesting as well. And it's got Angela as the lead of the Asgardians, so that should be interesting. I think Marvel's done a pretty good job at bringing her into this world. And of course, if you don't know who Angela is, I don't know why you wouldn't. That whole story is fascinating. I hope that at some point in the future, I get a chance to talk about Angela as a character, maybe in Secret Origins, because she first appeared in Spawn number 9. Neil Gaiman created her, and there's a whole legal battle that lasted for years and years and years. So, looking forward to Asgardians of the Galaxy number 1. That's from Marvel Comics. That is going to wrap up this episode of Comic Talk today. Thank you all for listening once again. You can, of course, find me on Twitter at Geekvine. NerdyLegion@gmail.com is the email address. Now we'll come back tomorrow with the news. I'll catch you then.